welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This week, my guest is Margarita Kellerick, newly named counsel at Pillsbury's Houston office. A diligent problem solver, Margarita has had a very diverse career, from working in-house at WeWork to investment banking. But now she works specifically with startups from every industry. She joins the show today to share a bit about her background and what she's learned along the way, as well as to give some very broad but free legal advice to startups based on some common challenges she sees from her clients. Margarita, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. This is my first podcast, Natalie.
Gosh, well, this is not our first. This is like our almost 150th episode, somewhere around there. And
wow.
Never had a lawyer on, or at least not one that I know of. So I'm excited. This is going to be a bit different of a conversation. We're going to talk a lot about startup law and all of the work you do with startups. But before we really dive into that, I wonder if you can share a bit about your background in law. What drew you exactly to working with startups?
Sure. So I started my career in New York 11 years ago. As a debt attorney. And what tends to happen to law students is you don't really know anything about the practice of law from going to law school. And so you end up choosing your practice area, if you get a choice at all, more or less randomly. You know, you might choose a firm that only does debt finance, and suddenly you're a debt finance lawyer. You know, you base it on the little bit of things that you get to do as an intern. But really, you're thrown into the fire, often into a practice area that you know very little about. And I remember when I started, the reason I chose my practice area, which was finance, was because the reputation for that group was that it was the hardest one. And so back then, you know, that's how I made decisions. I was like, if that's the hardest one, I'm going to prove to myself that I can do it. But really, when I started my career, I had a different goal in mind. I wanted to not be a lawyer. I wanted to be an investment banker. So I thought, I'm going to go into the finance group, which actually did, it represented companies in leveraged buyouts. So a private equity firm would buy a company using debt in the name of that company. It would take on a massive loan and use that loan to pay for the company itself. And I wanted to just learn as much as I could about finance at the time and then transition after, say, 2 years to being an investment banker. And during that time, I took the CFA. I, you know, took steps to learn the actual finances of what was going on, right? So, for example, I would work on bond deals. I took the CFA because I thought, well, if I'm going to work on bond deals, I should know how a bond is priced, right? What I noticed really early on is that as a lawyer, it can be really easy to put your head in the sand. You could do a full credit agreement, you know, borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars. And as a lawyer, it almost doesn't matter to you what the number is. But what's the most important thing in a loan? The dollar amount, right? So I spent a lot of time trying to learn the business of what I was doing. And 2 years in, I got an offer as an investment banker, and I didn't end up taking it. And so 2 years in, suddenly, the goal that I had was gone. And I had to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to do? Right. And so one of the things that I noticed in the first 2 years of working is, well, my actual work experience was great. The people I worked with were great. I got really great training. I liked that the work I did was technical and difficult. But what I noticed was that the effect of the debt on the companies themselves, right? So a typical private equity target is a company that is already making a lot of money. And if you were to say, look at McDonald's and Burger King, you might expect that their market valuation would be sort of similar, right? It turns out it's not at all. I haven't looked at it in a minute, but you know, at one point, the valuation of McDonald's was something like 10x Burger King. And why is that? It's because Burger King has been bought and sold by private equity multiple times, and McDonald's hasn't. And every time that it would, you know, Burger King would get bought and sold by private equity, what the private equity companies would do is they would take out a massive loan, And when they pay with debt, remember that the company is the borrower. So the company has a lot of debt. In order to make payments on that debt, it has to use some of its cash flow that it would have otherwise used on its employees or on its stores, right? And suddenly they start cutting costs, right? How do I make this cheaper? How do I make this better, right? And what I noticed was that over time, it was about taking as much money out of a business that was already successful and kind of leaving it a little bit of a skeleton than it was about like growing a business, right? It was about extracting value that was already there, not building value. And, you know, the difference between, say, an M&A associate and a finance associate is that after an M&A deal is done, you know, you move on to the next deal. After a finance deal is done, you get calls from your clients like, am I allowed to do this? I need to make payments. I need a short-term loan. And so because you live with them, you see what the effect of the debt on the business actually is. And I realized that those businesses were struggling, right? They would, you know, be constantly in default on their debt. And it upset me a little bit that I was participating in this thing that wasn't building, it was extracting. So I had a conversation with actually a legal recruiter, and I explained all of this, and they were like, you know what you might be interested in? Venture capital and startup work. Because what you're doing is you're working with a company from the very early stages and helping them build a business. And I was like, oh, that sounds really cool. And I had never considered it before. So I got a job at a New York firm that had a startup practice. New York was not at the time like a massive startup hub. But my goal there was, you know, spend a year, let's say, make a bunch of contacts, and then try to go in-house at like a venture capital firm or a company. 6 months later, somebody from my first firm called and said, hey, you know, my boss at WeWork is hiring his first corporate hire. Do you want to go in and interview? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So I went in, and it was like the energy was immediately different. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, my time at WeWork if, you know, if you like, people like to talk about it. But honestly, you know, at the time it had just gotten a $16 billion valuation. It was really exciting. I'd never been to a workplace like that before, right? Where you walk into a law office and things are quiet and everyone's doing their work and it's a nice place to work and everyone's super nice. But this place like was buzzing and it just immediately felt right. So I, you know, 6 months after I started at that law firm, I was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to WeWork. And then that was where my start in like startups, venture capital really started. I spent 2.5 years at WeWork, loved it, had a great time. My favorite parts were a year into my time at WeWork. My boss called me in his office and said, do you want to spend 6 months in China? And I said, no. What had happened was the general counsel of China had quit because he was like, I'm an adult and I don't need this. You know, you needed to have like a high tolerance for chaos to work there. And even though I said, no, I don't want to go to China, I went to China. And what I liked about China was I got to see the stage of WeWork that I had missed. One of the things that I sort of wished was, I wished I had been there earlier. I heard all these amazing stories, like when they were first starting, when they were first like, you know, building, and I felt like I missed out on all of that. And so when I went to China and I saw like a much younger market, I felt like I got to see WeWork in much earlier days. And, you know, that was even more exciting than when I first started at WeWork. I then went to Japan, and that was before the first WeWork even opened. We were working in like a conference room that somebody rented, like one long table, something like 30 people trying to work at the same table. It was chaos. But again, you know, just being part of that energy of like, we're going to start something new. We're going to build it from the ground up. That was, it was almost intoxicating, right? I got an opportunity after 2.5 years to be the first legal hire at one of WeWork's competitors, a company called Convene. And I started the legal team there from scratch, you know, after their Series D financing. And it was up to me to sort of build all the legal infrastructure. You know, they didn't have, you know, they needed new form contracts. Their sales contracts needed to be organized. You know, they needed somebody to manage all their outside counsel, all that kind of stuff. So it went from me to a team of, I think, it was five at the beginning of 2020, supposed to grow to eight. And then the pandemic hit. And Convene made most of its money by hosting events. So a lot of its spaces were underutilized spaces in office buildings, right? You might have like a lobby area or like a really nice second floor that nobody uses. And so what Convene would do is they would make it into corporate event spaces. You know, like all those like gross ballrooms and conference rooms at hotels that don't have windows for some reason. Yeah, we did that, but like way, way better. It was actually a pleasant experience. But, you know, beginning of 2020, sort of things just went to a standstill. And in August of that year, I sort of had like the hardest moment of my career so far. They were going to cut two members of my team. I was down to four already. They had cut somebody at the beginning of the year. And I said, what if you cut me instead? Do these two people get to keep their jobs? And they did. And so I left Convene. And those two got to keep their jobs. And I went to a family office private equity firm. And in that time, I met my now husband, who is an oil trader. And he had been going back and forth to Houston. I purposely picked a company that had a Houston office. I ended up moving to Houston with them in 2021. And then, you know, a year into my life in Houston, I realized I was hopelessly bored and lonely and didn't have any friends. And I needed to do something to change that. And so that's when I decided to go back to private practice, start going to startup events. And, you know, I talked to Pillsbury when I first went back to private practice, but it wasn't the time, and now I'm finally here.
Okay, I have never been so entertained by someone's like career history with all of the moves you made and all of the different types of work, which is surprising to me. And so it just seems like you have like a really varied experience to
yes.
provide.
Yeah, I did that on purpose, right? Because I think one of my bosses once said this. It was me and one of my colleagues, and she and I had both come from the same place. And we both had sort of the same basic training, but we did totally different work. And at one point he said, Rita, you like to know something about everything. Anne likes to know every single thing about like the thing she's working on. I was the type of person who like, I would listen in on my boss's phone calls and I'd be like, who are you talking to? What was that? Tell me about that. What's going on there? You know, I want to know everything. And so purposely, you know, I wanted to make sure that I had a general skill set because, you know, after 2 years of doing credit agreements, I sort of looked at them and I'm like, all right, what's the next thing? And they're like, no, that's it for 30 years. You just do the one type of agreement. And that just made me like want to blow my brains out. So another reason I wanted to do startup work is there's always a variety. You know, you never know what somebody's going to call you with.
Yeah, you're a problem solver.
Exactly. That's the goal.
So you mentioned it's a new role at Pillsbury. So you've just made the transition over. Tell me about what you're doing for them and what's different about your work now.
So when I went back to private practice, you know, I had been in-house for most of my career. And I had thought that I would be in-house. But at the point where I decided to go back to a law firm, I realized I had made all these amazing contacts from WeWork and Convene and from my time in New York. And a lot of it was in the startup space. And, you know, I had friends that, you know, what we would talk about was, oh, you know, like this person I know is starting a shoe company. What do we think of their strategy? We'd like sit down and break it down. And I realized that I wanted to work with the people that I had worked with in the past who were all doing new things again. And the only way that I could do that was if I went back to a law firm. And so, you know, again, it's about having like that variety and also being able to work with a wide array of people rather than just one client, which is what happens when you're working in-house, right? Your client is just the company that you work for. But, you know, at some point, I got too many calls from friends who were like, hey, so-and-so needs a lawyer. Can you just, you know, help them out real quick? And the answer is I can't, because I have professional responsibility obligations to, you know, my employer and things like that. So when I went to Latham, nobody had any startup lawyers at any of the big firms, as far as I could tell. And I had a mentor at Latham in New York who had been my outside counsel in the past. And so really the goal was, all right, I'm going to go to events. I'm going to meet people. I'm going to work on people's clients in Silicon Valley, New York, whatever. But Houston also seems to have some interesting startups of its own, right? And so it was an opportunity, you know, honestly, I went into those events trying to make friends because I didn't have any. And then, you know, when I have this instinct is when somebody tells me a problem, I'm like, let me solve that for you. And so that was really the impetus. And so what I started at Latham was going to events, getting to know people in Houston, getting to know what kind of startup market Houston has. What I noticed was there weren't any other lawyers showing up to the events. I have still not met another lawyer. As far as I'm aware, and I could be wrong, apologies in advance to any Houston big law attorneys who only do ECBC. But as far as I'm aware, I'm the only ECBC only attorney at a big law firm in Houston. There are plenty of people who do emerging companies work, but the trend seemed to be that they are private equity specialists who also do venture capital work or startup work, but that's a different type of work. And so, you know, what I really want to do at Pillsbury that I didn't get a chance to do at Latham was really spend time on investing in the Houston startup community, working with Pillsbury to throw events. I think that Latham is an awesome firm, but, you know, their startup practices are really on the coasts. And, you know, Pillsbury is really, really committed to the Texas market and the Houston market, and they're ready and willing to get their name out there and support me in the quest to help the Houston startup community grow.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, even outside of law, big companies, small companies, all like organizations, universities or whatever, it has to be this like kismet and like, you know, fortuitous moment of the person to do the work, like you, the parental entity, whether that's like a nonprofit or whatever, willing to, you know, trust that person and put it in. I mean, it's like all the things that we see successful in the Houston innovation ecosystem. And I'm just talking about that specifically, because obviously that's what we know. You see that, like, you know, success at Rice University, for example, came from the right person, the right time, the right funding, the right support for that activity. Anything else is going to fail. So I feel like it's a familiar story in Houston.
Yeah. I think it has to be hyper-local in Houston. I think that you can't fly in someone from Silicon Valley. You can't fly in somebody from New York, because they, I love New York, but I know that when I lived in New York, I had this sort of false consensus effect that the people around me were representative of the whole country. And what I believed was, you know, was the majority opinion, but that's just not true, right? And so you can't bring in somebody from New York or Silicon Valley to talk to people in Houston, because I think that they immediately seem out of touch. They immediately seem head in the clouds or not interested. You know, I know that there are firms who sponsor things here who, you know, run their startup practices out of Silicon Valley. And what I've seen is that when you put a Silicon Valley associate on a Houston startup, they don't invest the same type of interest. You know, what I said earlier about how you could do a credit agreement without ever knowing the dollar amount, you know, you could, as a lawyer, do an entire venture fundraising without knowing what the business does or without really caring beyond like a surface level. But I think that you don't give good legal advice when you don't really invest in what the company is doing. Like, as a lawyer, you should be really interested in what the company is doing. You should be bought in. You should believe in their success. And the better you know their business, the better advice you can give, right? And I think that there's just too much of a disconnect from somebody on a coast versus somebody who can like be here and show up to their plant and look at what they're building and touch it and, you know, meet them in person once a week, something like that, you know?
Yeah, that's such a great point. And the local element that needs to be there for success. It's not like, I feel like it feels presumptuous of us to be like, oh, no one understands us, but it's kind of true. Like, it's kind of true.
A little bit, right?
Houston,
You
to
know?
Really get what's happening. Okay, so shifting a little bit on this, because you mentioned you moved to Houston, you found clients to work with. So tell us about, obviously you can't tell us the specific clients you work with, but what types of clients are you working with, like stage, you know, industry, and then specifically how you're expanding that a little bit at Pillsbury?
Sure. So I'm pretty much industry agnostic. It's about the stage of the company and their expected trajectory. And I, you know, the perfect client for me is somebody who has started the company, knows what their product is, and is gearing up to raise their first round of financing, maybe via a safe, maybe, you know, via, you know, some kind of note, something like that. Or they have already done their safe financing and they're going to do their Series Seed in the next year. And they need to clean up some of their things in order to be ready for that. You know, we'll take startups even at the very earliest stages. We will form companies. Pillsbury was actually the firm that incorporated Standard Oil that is now Chevron, right? If it's a promising idea and a promising person, and it looks like there is, you know, maybe a 6-month trajectory to raising financing in the hundreds of thousands, let's say, that's a good client because, you know, we can get them set up. We can get them, you know, what they need at the very early stage, and we can represent them in that fundraise.
That's interesting because in a way you're almost like a VC in that you're kind of vetting potential clients to who seems promising. Obviously, you're not giving them money, they're giving you
Right.
money, but like I feel like you have to your limited resources, your time, and you have to decide
Yeah.
clients to like give time to.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. But I think at the same time, one of the things that we'll want to do as Pillsbury is set up, you know, things like office hours so that we can still be helpful to companies that aren't quite ready. You know, some companies just need, they don't need to hire a lawyer. They need someone to point them in the right direction. I've had so many people come to me and be like, you know, I need a referral for such and such type of lawyer. And they explain to me the problem. And I'm like, you don't need a lawyer. You shouldn't spend money on that. What you need is to tell them that you're an unhappy customer, things like that, right? There are, luckily, even if a company isn't ready to hire us, or, you know, if a company, let's say, looks like they're going to be successful, but they're not going to raise outside capital, they're going to be like entirely self-funded, and, you know, they don't really need a venture lawyer, I'll point them to something like PillsburyPropel.com, right? It's one of those resources that law firms typically have where they have all sorts of free free form documents, right? Like if you want a form in Delaware, there are actually a ton of law firm websites that you can go to that are specifically for startups, and you put in your information and it will spit out your Delaware formation documents for you. Now, should you have a lawyer read those and help you with them? Yes, probably. But could you do it on your own? Also, yes, right? It's really a question of, do you anticipate having to raise outside financing and therefore an outside investor looking at these documents? Or if you're going to be like a sole practitioner, for example, I don't want to charge you big law rates. If you're going to be a consultant, I'm not going to tell you that you should pay me $1,000 an hour because I don't think you need that. and I will help you find, you know, low cost or no cost resources or a smaller firm that might be able to help you and things like that.
Well, you talked a little bit about what you work on with your clients, but I wonder if you could like pretend you're on the other side of the table.
Sure.
At what point should startups be considering a lawyer? They're like specific stages, obviously, if they're raising money, but are there other reasons they should employ a lawyer? Early stage startups, that is.
Yeah, I think when you're starting your company, you really need to think about, okay, am I going to run this company with outside funding or without outside funding, right? And if you are aiming to get venture capital funding, honestly, you can get a lawyer day one. And the nice thing about attorneys in the startup space is that they won't, you know, if you're day one and you have a really promising idea and, you know, you're going to get venture fundraising, they're not going to charge you day one. They're going to help you get incorporated. They're going to help you get your equity set up. They're going to help you get, you know, some really basic scaffolding, let's say, to put you in a position where when you're ready to get in front of an investor, all your ducks are in a row and you have a clean set of documents, right? If you think that you're going to be more of like a sole consultant, you're not going to raise outside financing, you probably need, you might be able to go to LegalZoom.com and set up your LLC and be totally fine. The one piece of advice that I like to give basically everybody starting a business is that you should never give away something that you can't get back. So what are the things that you can't get back? In my view, it's your time and your reputation. So the mistake that I often see companies making is that they will avoid spending money on things like a trademark. Getting a trademark usually costs, let's say, $3,000 to $5,000. It can range, but that's a good ballpark. And they will feel like that's too much money for them to spend. But what I've seen when people fail to do that is basically catastrophic, right? Think about it this way. So in the case of a trademark, a friend of mine started a business and, you know, she picked out a name and she didn't vet it from a trademark perspective. And by the way, vetting can be really easy. You know, you can run like a low cost or no cost search. Go to Google, search the name that you want, see if there are other companies. Go to Amazon, search the name, see if there are products. Go to the USPTO, literally put into Google, USPTO trademark search, right? And it will lead you to a website that looks incomprehensible. It says tests at the top and it has a search bar, and put in the name that you want to use for your company and put in a few different variations, right? So, you know, let's say you want to name your company Apple Computer, okay? Put in Apple Computer, put in just Apple, put in Apple's Computer, put in Apple-y Computer, things like that, right? And see if there's already somebody else who has a trademark for the same thing. And if they do, stay away, okay? It's not worth your time. There's often an easy way to do things and a hard way to do things. And if a big company already has a name that might be similar to what you're doing, you're choosing the hard way. Don't do it. You're going to lose, and you're going to lose a lot of time. So what happened to the friend of mine is she built up a social media following and her business was getting successful. It was about a year in. She gets this letter and somebody else across the country in another state has a trademark for it. And, you know, I refer her to a trademark lawyer, and the trademark lawyer says, look, even though she's only in California, she registered this. She has the right to use this name exclusively nationwide. And it is her prerogative to tell you to stop using it, right? Because what if one day she wants to go to New York, right? The thing is, for the trademark owner, you know, that name is property. That name is just property that's not under lock and key. So at the end of the day, if you're using somebody else's trademark, you're using something that doesn't belong to you. You're using something that belongs to somebody else. And the USPTO literally is just a registry of who owns what names, okay? And so she ended up having to rebrand. And I think she lost about a year of her business, right? And so when you're a startup, right? And it's day one and you're looking at it and you're thinking, I don't know, I don't want to spend $5,000. Ask yourself, is losing 6 months of my business worth $5,000 to me? Is losing 12 months of my business worth $5,000 to me? Is that much of my time and effort worth it? Is losing that worth it? And I think the answer is no, right? And so, there are a few places where I would say you should spend the money early on. That's one of them, right? If you're going to say, if you know you want to raise money and you have a few co-founders, okay? I think one of the most common problems that startups have is co-founder disputes, right? So spend the time with a lawyer, sit down. They will probably defer the fees for this. But, write a prenup, basically. Write a prenup with your co-founder. That's what your sort of the initial startup process looks like. You sit down and you think about how much equity do I get? How much equity do you get? How much time should it vest? Do we have to earn this equity by being with the company over a certain number of years? What happens if something goes wrong, right? That's a lot of what lawyers think about is what happens if something goes wrong? That's really worth here to think about. And we want to make sure that if something does go wrong, like let's say you and your founder have profoundly different visions and one of you wants to leave, that is as least disruptive as possible, basically, right? Because again, one of those things could seriously disrupt your future, right? If you don't get your ducks in a row up front with your co-founder and you're trying to raise money and you're in a fight with your co-founder, what does that look like to your investor, right? That could seriously undermine an equity fundraise that you really need, right? So these are the kinds of things that you want to be thinking about. The other big thing up front is make sure that the company owns all the intellectual property that you and your co-founder create. So don't forget to do that part. Sign it up front. I assign all my IP to the company. Again, that's going to be a big one for equity fundraisers. They will want to make sure that because what are they paying you for, right? They're giving you money because they want to invest in the technology. And if the company doesn't actually own the technology, if a person owns it and they don't want to give it to the company, that's going to be a problem from an equity investment perspective for a VC. A lot of things for startups are really well baked and people use the same forms. So don't spend time reinventing the wheel. It can just save you like a bunch of time and effort if you just go to an attorney that already has all these forms, right? You think that you're saving money, let's say, by like writing your own bylaws. You're not. You're wasting time and money. And when you need to hire an attorney, they're going to have to redo it all for you. And it's going to cost you more money than if you had just gone to an attorney upfront and just paid to do it right the first time.
So I know you talked about all of this advice for the early stage, and a lot of it segues into VC fundraising, but maybe talk a little bit about, I think when you think of a startup raising funding, you think of there's two parties, there's the startup and then there's the VC firm. But obviously the lawyer plays an important role on the startup team. So talk about that role and what exactly you do in that situation.
So I think if it's okay, I want to kind of answer that more globally than VC fundraising. I think that a lawyer should be a strategic partner. A lawyer should never tell you, no, you can't do something. A lawyer should aim to tell you how to do something, right? A lawyer should be a problem solver that is on your team to help facilitate whatever it is that you want to do. And so by the time that you get to your venture fundraising stage, your lawyer should have already made sure that your equity documents are in order, your IP documents are in order. You are able, when you do a venture fundraising, you will have to provide basically all of the documents that the company has produced thus far to the to the venture capital firm for them to do their diligence, right? Because if you say you have customers, they want to see your customer contracts to make sure you have customers. If they, you know, you say you own this intellectual property, they want to see evidence that every single person who works for you has assigned all their intellectual property and that, you know, you have your patents or your trademarks or whatever it is that you need in order to create your product. So a lawyer should help you stay organized, right? A lawyer should make sure that you are sort of staying on track in the negotiation, that you're not missing the forest from the trees, right? You want your lawyer to be really practical, thinking about it from a business perspective and not thinking about it from, you know, the perspective of how do I eliminate all risk? You can't eliminate all risk, right? And venture fundraising documents are all typically on the NVCA form. The National Venture Capital Association publishes a set of forms for, you know, price rounds that everybody uses. And your lawyer should be, one, teaching you what's in the documents. Make sure that you understand what it is you're signing. The lawyer should be making sure that what's in the term sheet and what's in the documents matches the business deal that you actually struck, right? So, you know, I can't tell you how many times somebody has said, hey, can we just sign this? And it's not necessarily about a venture fundraising. And I'll say, this says you're going to spend $100 million. Did you agree to that? And they're like, no. I'm like, then why are we signing this, guys, right? You know, a lawyer should be helping you understand what's in the contracts. And, you know, if the lawyer sees you fixating on a point that's really not going anywhere, the lawyer should give you practical advice on how to strike a compromise, for example, right? Which risk factors are going to be important for your business and which ones aren't? The lawyer should be identifying those, right? It's about helping you articulate and write down the business deal that you came to, helping you identify the most salient risks in a transaction and address those, and helping you identify what's the least important and sort of being able to give those away. You know, I often play a lot of role that's a lot more than just legal. You know, I've had, often it's about operational problem solving, right? Often it's about just holding the founder's hand and telling them that what they're doing is right. You know, I've had to talk founders down from trying to bail on a deal. They're like, this guy is being unreasonable. I shouldn't take money from him. And you know, we'll either tell them, yeah, you're right, this person is being crazy, or no, this is normal in this kind of transaction. Don't worry about it. You know, particularly in the context of, say, like a buyout, right? I did a founder buyout last year. And at the beginning of the process, I sort of sat him down and I said, listen, I want you to understand, this process is going to be long. It's going to be messy. It's going to take longer than you think. And it's going to be painful at times. But just understand, this is normal. I've never had one of these close on time. And, you know, I don't want you to interpret, say, somebody dragging their feet as the deal falling apart. And sort of what ended up happening was, we played them so hard in the term sheet stage that we had to give up some almost silly points when we got to the final documentation, because I think their egos were bruised from the fact that my client essentially got everything he wanted in the term sheet. And so, you know, we had to give up a little bit to make them feel like they were winning. But we came up with a negotiation strategy together and it worked. That's the kind of thing that we do.
Another problem solved.
Another problem solved.
You know,
I was talking earlier today to a junior associate about how often in disputes with like co-founders or even vendors, often what the other party wants is, and she said, payouts. And I said, no, they want to be heard. They want to be told they're right. And you often don't have to change your ask. You just have to listen to them, tell them, yeah, you're right, that wasn't fair. I'm going to give you $5 And often just hearing, yes, you're right, and letting them vent and letting them feel heard is enough for them not to come back and say, no, I want 15. That's often enough for them to feel okay accepting $5 or whatever it was, you know?
Yeah, I hate that that would kind of work for me as someone who
It,
likes being right.
it's not just you, it works for a shocking amount of the time.
Well, this has been so enlightening. I feel like if startup founders are, well, startup founders are listening and they're probably taking lots of notes and are so much better prepared to navigate the startup journey from a legal perspective. So thank you so much for all of that. I think just to wrap up, something that we talked about earlier on is your transition from New York City to Houston. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that transition. I know you mentioned having to get to know the ecosystem too. So tell us about how you did that. I'm sure there's some founders who haven't fully tapped in and can probably learn a bit from how you managed to do it.
Sure. I think one of the ways I did it was actually by finding Natalie here and hounding her until she agreed to have drinks with me. But really, I started going to events, and I think that for anybody new to the ecosystem, check out the Ion, check out Greentown Labs. Every day I'm learning about new accelerators, new startup programs here. There is so much going on. I really feel like what I like about Houston as a startup ecosystem is that it's a startup itself. And that's my absolute sweet spot. I feel like for anybody who wants to be involved, I think not only is there an opportunity to participate, but there is an opportunity if you want to take a really like active role in helping to build it. Because I think the community needs more builders, and it has some really great people who are already starting to build it. People like Natalie, people like Wade Pinder, for example. And there are tons of other examples, but I think if you're committed to startups and you want to be a builder, Houston's a great place to do it, even if you just want to help other startups. But really, it was about going to events, and you know, you want to find the person who organized the event and go up and introduce yourself and say, hey, you know, I'm new to the startup community. Who should I meet? What events should I go to? People tell you, and it's awesome. And you start going to those events and you start meeting people. And I think it's a really friendly place. It's a really nice place to get involved in the community. And I think it needs more of literally everybody. Needs more founders, needs more service providers. So whatever your role is in the ecosystem, even if you're just curious, I would recommend people to go out.
Yeah, absolutely. We should shout out Bayou City Startups, which does this
Yes.
month. It's like even in the summer when I feel like startup activity or event activity specifically
Yep.
is slower, there's that every month and in perpetuity. I think it's the
Yeah.
third.
I try to go every month. So if anyone wants to come say hi, please come to Bayou City Startups events. Come find me.
That's where you can find Rita.
I will talk your ear off.
This is true. She will. As this episode is a pretty
Sorry. Sorry
about.
For talking at you, Natalie.
That's okay. This is what I'm here for. Well, I think this is a good place to stop. We have covered a lot and it was very enlightening again. So thank you so much for joining the show and for sharing.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
First lawyer at that, at least of my knowledge.
And this is my first podcast.
Perfect. Making history. Awesome.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.